Welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast, number 357. I'm Tom Cagley, your host, and in this week's Software Process and Measurement Cast, we'll start with our essay on mind mapping. I view mind mapping as a great technique to stimulate creative thinking and organize ideas. Mind mapping is one of my favorite tools. Note, this essay has a lot of visual examples. While they are explained in the reading of the essay, I have also included them in a separate document for reference on the website. We also feature Steve Tendon's column discussing the Tame Flow methodology and Chapter 4 of his great book, Hyperproductive Knowledge Work Performance. Steve and I discuss the impact of management's profound understanding of knowledge work and that understanding's impact on the delivery of value. Anchoring the cast will be Gene Hewson, returning with an entry from his Form Follows Function blog. This week, Gene discusses the idea in his entry, Who Needs Architects? A quick call to action. For the remainder of August and September, let's try something a little different. Forget about iTunes reviews and tell a friend or a coworker about the Software Process and Measurement Cast. Let's use word of mouth to grow the audience for the podcast. After all, the Spamcast provides you with value. Why keep it to yourself? Mind mapping, Thomas M. Cagley Jr., Megan E. Cagley. A number of years ago, I was the chair of the IFPUG conference committee. Finding a keynote speaker that had the gravitas to fill seats and would challenge the audience on a budget was a difficult chore. I had been pursuing Ed Yurden for a few years. However, he was too expensive. In 2002, my annual begging and the weak conference market convinced Ed to give IFPUG a break so we could afford him. A few weeks before the conference, Ed announced that he would not be providing a set of PowerPoint slides, but rather would be using something called a mind map. I think I considered calling in sick to the conference. I was so worried by the approach. In retrospect, Ed's use of mind mapping represented one of those life-changing moments for me. Mind mapping is a technique for mapping information using colors, pictures, and symbols, and most importantly, a branching structure emanating from a central concept. Tony Buzan popularized the technique and term mind mapping in 1974. Mind mapping includes and leverages ideas and techniques from other problem-solving techniques and concepts, such as radiant thinking and general semantics. Mind mapping lets you organize your thoughts in a nonlinear manner that allows you to see the whole picture at once, and the relationships between the components of the map. According to Buzon, outlining, one of the most popular techniques for gathering and organizing information, forces users into a top-to-bottom, left-to-right view of data. Outlining, by its nature, can impart a deterministic view of the topic being studied, a form of cognitive bias. The popular psychology promoted by Buzon, suggests that mind mapping, by using words, colors, and pictures and symbols, engages more parts of the mind. In the blog entry, Learning Styles and Teams, we discuss the 7 learning styles model. The link is in the show notes. Each style absorbs and processes information differently. But while everyone has a predominant style of learning, they also are influenced by other styles. The use of multiple techniques to gather information, organize, and convey information engages multiple learning styles. Therefore, we would expect mind mapping to be useful to a broad range of learners. Mind maps have a few drawbacks. I've observed that some people are, or trained to be, very linear thinkers. The nonlinear approach to mind mapping does not work well for linear thinkers. These types of thinkers generally also have trouble with techniques like affinity diagramming. If you are a linear thinker, feel free to experiment with mind mapping, but remember that you will always have the classic outlining techniques to fall back on if the lack of perceived structure is bothersome. Note, this is not meant to be a put-down on linear thinking. Linear and nonlinear thinkers are needed in every team. Each type of thinker has value and provides a team with diversity of approach that often yields better ideas and solutions. A second drawback is since when you draw a mind map, the map is a reflection of how you think. In many cases, this means the resulting map will be difficult for others to interpret. If a group is going to use a mind map to plan work, one we use for a mind map, I strongly suggest building the map as a group effort. The branching and tree-like structure of a mind map presents a central concept at the center of the map with major topics radiating from that topic. The map continues to branch out to the level of granularity that's important to the person drawing the map. A mind map allows the user to organize and visualize information so it can be consumed both at a big picture level and then drill down to a granular level in a manner that exposes relationship and engages the senses. How to build mind maps. Mind maps are built using a fairly standard set of practices. I will walk through two of the basic patterns used to construct a mind map. The basic process flow for all mind maps is 1. Draw a circle in the middle of a piece of paper, or if you're using a tool, in the middle of the tool's perceived piece of paper, and write the theme in the bubble. The theme is generally a word or a phrase that will be used to guide the building of the mind map. For example, the central theme for this week's essay is mind mapping. And for last week in the blog, it was agile success factors. Add branches beginning from the central theme, depending on the type of mind map. Most are developed down the major branches or in more of a starburst pattern if you're using brainstorming techniques. Developing mind maps is generally an iterative process. 3. Refine the mind map. After completing the initial mind map, walk through the major and minor subdivisions to determine whether the topics should be rearranged or whether there are gaps that need to be filled. Refining a mind map is also an iterative process. The basic processes can be leveraged with minor tweaking for many types of mind maps. An example in the essay that we'll walk through in a second is a topic-driven mind map using that central theme concept. 1. Draw the topic in a circle in the middle of the paper. Before you commit to a topic for a mind map, think carefully about where the topic might drive you. For example, if I chose the topic of mind maps rather than mind mapping, the subtle difference in wording could cause the focus to shift from how to mind map to what is mind mapping. So figure 1 shows an oval with the term mind mapping inside of it. 2. Based on the central theme, identify the major subdivisions or subcategories. In figure 2, with that central oval of mind mapping, around the outside, I've put in subtopics of what, a second one of drawing, a third one of rules, and a fourth one of uses. Each one of those will be taken down to a different level as we move forward. In many cases, the person building the mind map will have a general understanding of the major subdivisions. Therefore, listing the subdivisions makes sense. Where you're less sure, I would let the subdivisions emerge using a starburst or a shotgun method of developing a mind map. We're going to go into that in a little greater detail below. But in essence, it's a brainstorming mechanism, and then grouping generates the subdivisions. Do not be afraid to add, change, or delete as you go, regardless of the technique. 3. Break the major subdivisions into relevant level of detail. For example, in figure 3, I take the concept of what is a mind map, one of those major subdivisions, and break it down into a number of different. So right below that is the history of mind mapping. We talked about that earlier in this essay, the discussion of Tony Bazzone. And then as part of that what subtopic, I've also included a section on human thinking related. And that breaks down the whole discussion between analytical and artistic thinking, nonlinear, fully engages the brain, things like that. In terms of drawing, we talked, that was a second subdivision. There were a number of pieces broken off of that. The processes, topic-driven, brainstorming, starburst that we'll talk about a little later on. Each layer can be listed as divergent or as components of each layer and broken down more and more finely. So brainstorming is a good process to jumpstart breaking subdivisions down. When using the process for mind mapping, I generally begin with a bit of research to prime the pump and focus, followed by brainstorming to drive out details, and then more research to fill the gaps. Drawing a topic-driven mind map is generally where new mind mappers begin. A topic-based approach provides structure to guide building a mind map. The one downside I've experienced with beginning with a topic-driven mind map is that the assumption of major subcategories can be constraining, similar to the anchor bias that we've discussed many times in essays. Generating a mind map in a group session that includes diversity of thoughts is one way to avoid constraints and to leverage mind maps to help think out of the linear box. Tony Bozzone, in his book, The Mind Mapping Book, added four characteristics to the definition that further define mind maps. They are, 1, the topic is the central image, main themes radiate from the center, branches are represented by a key image or word, and then finally, branches are connected. I would add a fifth characteristic. Topics that are less important tend to be placed farther from the center of the image, from the center image. These five characteristics can be mined for rules to draw a mind map. 1, use images. Images engage visual and physical learning styles that encourage memory. Bozzone suggested that the central theme should be an image. When hand-drawn, the use of an image provides a strong anchor for the mind map. Drawing an image adds another layer of involvement in the map through the physical nature of drawing. 2, use single words and short phrase or a short phrase when you can't use images. When using phrases, make them as short as possible. 3, color. Color can provide added meaning to images and words. For example, the use of the color red conveys danger or urgency, dependent on context, while green tends to portray growth. Frankly, I'm colorblind, or pretty close to total. So I use color sparingly as combinations I find pleasing, others find befuddling. That's why plaid is my favorite color. Think about that for a second. Use color to draw attention. Show linkages between items or highlight items that are helpful to you. While some think of mind maps as art, I think they are a tool that just happens to look cool. Weighting can be used to show the relative importance of each topic. Two types of weighting can be used. Varying font or image size is one way to convey importance. The larger the font, the more important the entry. Second, the mind mapper can vary the length, the width of the branch. This form of weighting can be difficult or unavailable if you're using a computer-based tool for mind mapping. The goal of weighting is to draw attention to specific features, to increase memory retention, or to increase readability. Remember, not all entries or subdivisions are created equal. An example in Figure 4 shows exactly what we just talked about. The what, using our mind mapping example, what is very small, not the most important piece of what we're trying to convey with this essay. Drawing is fairly large because how to do it is important. Rules and suggestions is slightly smaller, and starred, again, to draw attention, not as large as drawing, somewhat or very nearly as important. And then finally, uses is smaller than both drawing and rule suggestions and colored blue because, very frankly, important. But if you don't know how to draw it, you don't know what the rules are, knowing the uses doesn't matter. Cross-linking is another way to show relationships between items that are not within the same branch. For example, in Figure 5, we show that it's possible that a major subdivision might be related directly to an item in another major subdivision, and so drawing a linkage, drawing an arrow between the two, shows that if you're going to consider one, you need to consider the other. Linkages allow the mind mapper to layer in nuances that might not be observable without repeating entries. You don't want to repeat the same thing over and over and over again. Cross-linkages allow you to do that. I consider these rules to be important, but not absolute. I've created many mind maps whose branches include links to websites or whole paragraphs of notes. I broke the rules because breaking them provided more value to me than not breaking them. The only two hard and fast rules are, one, the core topic and branch structure. Two, all the other rules are guidelines. The rules and guidelines for mind mapping exist to help the mind mapper get the most value from the map possible. The map should engage as many of the senses and learning styles as possible. How to use your mind map. Mind maps have a wide variety of uses based on one central theme, learning. The uses of mind maps include, one, note-taking. Most lectures tend to follow a more linear outline with relationships and linkages between topics inferred. Standard note-taking is generally a reflection of how the lecturer thinks rather than how the note-taker thinks. Mind mapping helps the note-taker to capture the branches of a topic and then visualize the linkages. Christine Green, a friend of mine, mind maps all of her notes, and very frankly, the way she thinks about the information as it comes in is helpful for her to retain it. Structuring notes based on how the note taker thinks makes memory recollection easier. Note, I occasionally use this technique to structure standard notes as a means to reinforce my own memory. 2. Planning. Few plans are linear. Mind maps are useful tools for planning and visualizing program-level backlogs. The branching structure of the map provides a tool to show how functionality breaks down and then visualize the linkages, dependencies, between the entries. While every story should be independent, story and task interdependence is generally a goal rather than a fait accompli in many organizations. A second use for mind maps in the planning category is as a tool to capture sprint planning results. The sprint goal serves as a central theme while stories radiating from the theme. Activities and tasks branch from the stories. Relationships can be added to show predecessors and successors or as trigger for replanning. Research 3. Using a mind map as a tool in research is very similar to how mind mapping is used in note-taking, with a few subtle differences. The first is that the mind mapper is generally gathering data from multiple sources while looking for gaps or unnoticed relationships as data is acquired. I often use mind maps as a tool for gathering and reorganizing information that I collect. Many tools support clipping URLs and information for bibliographical entries. The real power of mind maps as a research tool is the ability to visualize the collected data, which generally makes gaps obvious and can be useful when looking for relationships between two branches of research. 4. Presentation tool. In the entry, Mind Mapping and Introduction, which was one of the first blog entries I did on mind mapping, at the beginning of this essay, I recounted the story of Ed Yurden using a mind map to direct his presentation. I have developed mind maps as a precursor to building a classic PowerPoint presentation. When developing or giving a presentation from a mind map, the flow of information reflects how you have visualized and reflected it on the map. Organizing thoughts. This is my favorite use for a mind map. I begin organization process by generating my central theme, then using the theme as a hub, adding each central item I can think of based on that theme. I generally do this on paper without worrying about spelling or whether one or two items are duplicates. The goal is to get everything that is known around the central theme. It will generate a starburst pattern, as we've discussed before. That's given as example 6, which is done on a piece of paper from one of my notebooks. Once the starburst is created, the map can be mined to establish the major subdivisions and to indicate where more research is needed. Walk through each entry and gather related items together. From the items you gather together, the name of the subdivisions will emerge. For example, in our mind mapping mind map, which we've used as an example throughout, when I gathered note-taking, planning, research, and others together, the major subdivisions called uses emerged. It wasn't where I started. And that's shown in figure 7. Every daily process thought that we've written over the past few years begins with this kind of a mind map, starburst and then mined in to determine central themes. Many people use the term brainstorming for this type of mind mapping activity. Mind maps are tools for visualizing data, seeing your thoughts put into patterns that represent how you think makes it easier to remember the ideas and concepts being mapped. Mind maps also help the mapper see gaps in the data or to jog creative thoughts by exposing relationships that do not jump out when processed linearly. Mind mapping is an extremely flexible tool, therefore there are an enormous number of uses. There is a saying that if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything will look like a nail. Given the varied number of uses for mind maps, perhaps they might be an information visualization Swiss Army knife. Thoughts, comments, all welcome. Please feel free to leave us a message at 440-668-5717. Record a message on your smartphone and send it to spamcastinfo@gmail.com. Or just go old style and write me an email and send it to spamcastinfo@gmail.com. I look forward to the conversation. And remember, a PDF of all the examples will be at the blog at www.tcagley.wordpress.com, and we'll get the essay edited and out to you as soon as humanly possible. Steve, chapter 4, you titled this one, and as I read it over the weekend, you know, there were a couple of words that I tripped through, but you titled this one, Management's Profound Understanding of Knowledge Work. So before we dive into the concepts, the word profound, I think, is a little squishy. What do you mean by management's profound understanding of knowledge work? What do you mean by the word profound in that?
With profound, I mean that they really get it. But they don't know that they are getting it. That's the second part, which I develop in that chapter. In the earlier chapter, in chapter 3, we presented the idea that knowledge work needs empiricism. And we also said that, unfortunately, management schools do not teach that. They approach management from a deterministic perspective. We also concluded that managers referring to their deterministic models are not able to effectively manage knowledge worker organizations. And now here I come in chapter 4 and say that managers have a profound understanding of knowledge work. So it obviously seems like a contradiction. Managers do not know how to manage knowledge work because they are not trained to do it, but they habitually exercise some skills which are the essence of managing knowledge work. And what are those skills? Well, basically, those are the skills that managers, especially top managers, senior managers, exercise when they are doing strategies, when they're making strategies. Strategies for a manager are like the code for a programmer, and they face the same uncertainties that you have in knowledge work. So there is no other way than to proceed in an empirical manner, maybe referring to one's own experience and knowledge that you can gain through the conversations with your colleagues or subordinates. So we have that social dimension of working together collaboratively. And when managers develop a strategy, they are pretty much making guesses about what works and what does not. And then it's only through the implementation of that strategy and the feedback that comes from the field that they will understand whether they were right or not. And if they are not right, and if they are smart, they will learn quickly and adapt their strategies to reality. And there is a very severe teacher overlooking this learning process, and that is called the market. Those managers which are not able to adapt quickly will obviously fail in the market. So managers have a very good understanding of how to deal with empirical processes. Unfortunately, when they try to manage knowledge work, they go back to what they learned in business school and apply the deterministic process. So despite having the knowledge, the deep knowledge of how to do this, they are not able to do it by training.
You use the whole idea of strategy making to draw out, I think, the difference and why they do. You also use the phrase, the wicked problem of strategy making. And one of the takeaways in that was that I always use the line, there's a consequence to an action. But in essence, trying something, trying a solution irrevocably changes the world around it. How do those kinds of concepts fit into your idea that management has a profound understanding of knowledge work?
Well, relating to agile practices, we are all very familiar with the idea that you try to get to working code and demo the code to the stakeholders. Well, that is exactly what I'm trying to convey there, that you make decisions and try to implement out in the world, then you observe. You're waiting for feedback, the demo. Is the feedback good? Did we learn something? Do we need to do something different? You cannot know a priori. You must test the waters, and then you will get the feedback that will tell you what is the next step. In that sense, strategy making has similarities with software development.
Excellent. That list of 10 items, though, by the way, I know we're still very early in the book. That list of 10 items really was thought-provoking, and I counsel the listeners to take a hard look at that and think about all 10 of those in terms of software development. Mm-hmm. Product development. And it's interesting going down that path later on in the chapter. I think you started to tease out sort of something I've been thinking about lately, the distinction between product and process and project and how all of those fit together. What sort of language would you use in terms of product and process in that chapter?
If I refer back to the first couple of chapters where I talked about the case of Borland International and the study that Jim Coplin did about that, one thing that clearly emerged was that hyper-productive team was focusing much more on the product than on compliance to some kind of process. In fact, there was no process at all, one could say, with respect to what the standard expectations were at the time in terms of software development processes. Focusing on the product will inevitably make you think about the process as well. So it will get you to resolve those aspects, but in a different way. And what I highlight in this chapter is that there are other schools of thinking that come to the same conclusion. As a matter of fact, much earlier than the Agile Manifesto was published. The school of thinking I'm referring to is in the Austrian School of Economics, where they have some classification of how capital goods are used to produce different parts of some goods. And one very interesting aspect is that the whole process of producing a product is seen not as something mechanical. It's seen as something organic that brings together the dispersed collective knowledge of all people involved in the making of whatever it is you're making, and then embodying that knowledge into the product. Now, that is like another way of expressing the essence of software development processes that go from ideation, requirements, coding, testing, and so on, until at the other end you have working code. And it's interesting that this same concept has been found from an entirely different perspective. And even though the result might be similar, the theoretical underpinning is completely different. And you do focus on the product, but in doing so, in order to collect this dispersion of ideas in different minds and make something unique by embodying all those ideas into a product, well, by focusing on the product, you're obviously also fixing the process.
The focus on the process, doesn't that somehow tease us down the deterministic path, or couldn't it?
Indeed, it does. And referring to the ideas of TameFlow, I often try to explain where the process fits in the overall management understanding of what is going on. Why are processes invented in the first place? Well, they come from the evolution of craftsmanship into industrial production. And you want a process whenever you need to teach someone to do some work, but you want to avoid to stay there behind his back, overlooking every little step that is being done. So the process, imagine like a flow chart, if you wish, is nothing else than a substitute of a diligent supervisor. By following a checklist, a very deterministic expression of things to do, things get faster because you don't need to reconfirm every single step with the nod of a supervisor. That's the essence of why you need a process. But that worked when you had machines. And the problem is that in knowledge work, you don't have machines. Processes fail exactly for the reason we highlighted earlier. This is an empirical thing that needs iteration and feedback loops. So how can we deal with that? Well, the agile approach, if I said that the process was could be represented by a flowchart. Well, the agile approach, if you want an image for that, I would say is represented by a heart, because it goes very deep into how people communicate and interact. Now, both the process and the communication and interaction, which is posed by agile, actually aim at one same thing, and that is to enable the people doing the work to make the best possible decision as quickly as possible. So it's really about decision making. In the manufacturing world, you use processes. In the software development world, we have found agile. But I've been asking myself, well, is that really the best we can make? And I come to the conclusion that no, it's not. We can go much further.
So we can do much better. I think that takes us, and the next time we get together, we start into management's responsibility and learning for the organization. Yeah. And then as we move forward, we're going to, I think, explore some of those things that could be done in advance of where we are today, or at least where some people are today. In terms of the listeners, if from chapter 4 we'd like them to think about something very specific and take a specific action, what would you like them to do?
Well, probably I have one example there at the end, which, when I first read about it, I thought it was brilliant. And that is about how all the making of knowledge work can be compared to the performance arts. When artists have to set up a show, that process is very chaotic. There's a lot of uncertainty. But what is amazing is that they always hit the deadline. As I say in the book, if the show is not ready by opening night, it will not be long-lived. So what I would like people to reflect on is, well, what is this show business of software development? How does this relate to people preparing to go up on a stage at a theater? If you see that connection, it's very powerful. Why? Because it highlights the role of social interactions and communication. To make a show happen, people just have to talk, obviously. They even talk on the stage when they are delivering the show. What about software? How intense are all your communications, all your interactions? How frequent, how intense? Are they good enough? That's the question.
Excellent. Steve Tendon, co-author of Hyperproductive Knowledge Work Performance, the Tame the Flow Approach and its Application to Scrum and Kanban. Thank you for bringing your book to the Software Process and Measurement Cast, and we look forward to Chapter 5 next.
Thank you, Tom, and to the next episode.
Gene Hewson, welcome back to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
Gene, it is always exciting to have you come on and talk through one of your blog entries. If you don't know and you haven't listened to one of the podcasts before, Gene, it can be found at genehewson.wordpress.com. Gene writes the wonderful Form Follows Function blog. So, Gene, why don't we dive in? And recently, you wrote an article that you titled, Who Needs Architects Because Yagni Doesn't Scale? Gene, where were you going with that? Before you dive in on that one, I've got to say, anybody who can quote Rush, and you actually started that one off with a quote from Kent Beck and then followed it up with Rush, you know, combining those two is quite a feat.
It's always a good blog entry when you can go to ancient source of wisdom, aka classic rock.
Amen.
I've had a long history with what I call bumper sticker philosophies. Basically, those short, pithy, and for the most part, as I say, so lacking in nuances to be dangerous sayings that people latch onto really without thinking. And without thinking is, to me, a real red light when we're talking about software development. At least for me, the essence of software architecture is decision-making. And that decision-making, in my opinion, should be based on a rational appreciation of the context you're dealing with, not here's a slogan that I picked up and I'm going with this. And Yagni is one of those ones that's kind of right at the top of my list.
Yagni stands for?
You ain't gonna need it. Because as I like to point out frequently, sometimes you are gonna need it. And in most cases where you are gonna need it, and it turns around to bite you that you don't, it's something that really should not be a big surprise. To use one of Tlaib's sayings, it's not a black swan. Someone with a minimum of experience should be able to foresee things like need for scale, need for security. Don't think it should be a big surprise to anybody in 2015 that if you're going to put an application out that's publicly accessible, there needs to be an appropriate level of security. And again, going with the Rush quote that I put up, choosing to defer that decision is making a decision. You're deciding that you're going to be able to implement a fair portion of an application without including some fundamental core aspect of that application until later. Bolting on fundamentals after the fact is, you know, in my opinion, a really bad idea. You run a much greater risk of leaving out something, having something that's an ill fit to your context. Those things are much better, at least considered upfront. Going in blindfolded just doesn't, to me, seem like a good idea.
Why an architect? And, you know, aren't we, to sort of paraphrase Fred Brooks, aren't we creating a sort of an elite that thinks for the team or thinks for the team of teams if you're doing a large application?
Sure. That is a danger. Absolutely. Another one of my pet ideas is the idea of collaborative architecture. Thinking for people tends to be a really bad idea for a lot of reasons. One of which is it tends to rub people the wrong way. Even more importantly is the fact that nobody is omniscient. There's always something that you can miss. In one of my early blog entries was an old story about a British admiral who was kind of the hotshot of the British Navy in the 1890s, and he drowned after running his entire fleet into each other on maneuvers because the helmsman of the ship he was on tried to warn him that the turning radiuses of the two groups of ships would overlap, and the helmsman was stared down because he was questioning the preeminent sailor in Her Majesty's Navy.
That's a little bit of karma.
Yeah. It's one of those things. Listening to other people is absolutely important. Taking feedback, collaborating rather than dictating, really does two things. One is it can save you a lot of grief when somebody realizes something that you don't. The other thing is it's kind of a teachable moment. And I think rather than a dictator, an architect should be a mentor, a teacher, somebody who is making sure the development team is aware of those kind of cross-cutting concerns that an architect should be aware of. And that's really my biggest justification for an architect is the old tragedy of the commons. You need somebody thinking about those cross-cutting concerns, someone whose responsibility is those concerns rather than any one feature that the individual members of the development team will be spending the majority of their focus on. The development team should be cognizant of considering architectural concerns, but obviously each developer's, the majority of their focus is going to be on what's on their plate at the moment.
You tied that whole blog entry up with the discussion of whether or not it's possible to architect the perfect system or to architect it perfectly. Is it?
Perfectly? No. I always tell people the problem with perfection is by the time you've implemented perfection, the definition of it has moved on. The best you can hope for in my opinion, is what I refer to as an optimal system. The system that best fits the context under the circumstances. And the biggest factor in doing that, I believe, is flexibility. Understanding what decisions, what the costs as well as the benefits are. Sometimes going down a particular road is going to limit your options in that respect in the future. Knowing when you're going to start shutting doors is important, and making sure the benefit you're getting for that cost is crucial.
Gene Hewson, thank you for bringing your wonderful Form Follows Function blog that can be found at www.genehewson.wordpress.com to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Thank you, Tom.
In the next Software Process and Measurement Cast, we will feature our interview with Julia Wester. Julia is an improvement coach at LeanKit and writes the Everyday Kanban blog. Julia and I had a wide-ranging conversation that included both process improvement and the role of management in Agile. Julia's take is that management can play a constructive role in helping Agile teams deliver the most value. Remember that the Reread Saturday of the Mythical Man Month is in full swing. In upcoming events, remember, I will be at the Software Quality and Test Management Conference in San Diego, September 13th through 18th. I'll be speaking on the impact of cognitive biases on teams. Let me know if you are attending. I'd like to get together. The Agile Development Conference East, November 8th through 13th, 2015, in Orlando, Florida. I will be speaking on November 12th on the topic of Agile risk. Let me know if you're going, and we'll have a Spamcast meetup. And there'll be no risk to that. The Software Process and Measurement Cast is a proud member of the Tech Podcasting Network. If it's tech, then it's on the Tech Podcasting Network. Check out the Software Process and Measurement Cast and other great podcasts on TPN, www.techpodcast.com. As many of you know, I do at least one webinar for the IT Metrics and Productivity Institute every year. I think this is a very valuable organization. The IT MPI's mission is to pull together the expertise and educational efforts of the world's leading IT thought leaders and to create a single online destination where IT practitioners and executives can meet all of their educational and professional development needs. Well, except for the Spamcast, of course. The IT MPI offers a premium membership that gives members unlimited free access to 400 PDU accredited webinar recordings and waives the PDU processing fees on all live and recorded webinars. The Software Process and Measurement Cast receives a fee if you sign up using the URL in the show notes. Definitely see it in the show notes. All revenues from our sponsor goes to bandwidth, hosting, and new cool equipment to create more and better content for you. Support the Spamcast and learn from the IT MPI. The Spamcast blog and show notes can be found at www.spamcast.net. Contact Spamcast at spamcastinfo@gmail.com. Voice messages can be left at 1-206-888-6111. I also Twitter, and my Twitter ID is tcagley, so please track me down. It's my intent to share all voice messages, emails, Twitters. Your comments, questions, rants are appreciated and will help to facilitate a dialogue and build community. Let me know the topics that you would like to have covered and the people you'd like to get interviewed. Get involved. The music on Spamcast is made available by the PodSafe Music Network at www.podshow.com. The featured song is by 2012 and is titled Last Battle. Information on the band can be found at www.myspace.com/2012vision.com. 2012 does an incredible job with experimental electronica. Be sure to support 2012 and all PodSafe artists. Spamcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 3.0 license. If process improvement is a never-ending journey, why do so many people ask, when will we arrive?
See you next week.